up turning a sizable profit for taxpayers while doing more than any other public or private action to help resuscitate the housing market. But while the takeover of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac was absolutely necessary and broke the panic over their securities, it did not break the panic in the broader system. If anything, it sent an unintended message that the system was more fragile than ever. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were strange hybrids. They had federal charters to promote affordable home ownership, but they were also lucrative private firms that dominated the secondary mortgage market. These government-sponsored enterprises, or GSEs, had deep influence with both parties in Washington and exploited assumptions that the government would never let them fail to borrow heavily at below-market rates without much of a capital buffer. They were basically the corporate embodiment of moral hazard, enjoying the upside of their risk-taking while taking comfort that taxpayers would cover any downside. They did not cause the crisis, as some critics have suggested. Until late in the boom, the underwriting for mortgages they bought and backed was relatively conservative for the industry. But they did relax their standards before the bust, and by guaranteeing so much mortgage debt in the first place, they did help facilitate the tsunami of foreign money into U.S. real estate that set the stage for the crisis. All three of us, like our predecessors, had been deeply concerned about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac for years. We had all supported sweeping reforms of their business model and stricter regulation of their risk-taking. The CEOs of both companies had agreed to raise more equity when Hank had called them during the heat of Bear Weekend, but only Fannie Mae had raised any, and not nearly enough. Shortly after Bear collapsed, Hank had taken the CEOs to meet Senate Banking Committee Chairman Christopher Dodd and ranking Republican Richard Shelby, who had reached an agreement to try to jumpstart the House passed reforms in the Senate, but the legislative process wasn't moving as fast as the markets. By the summer, our top priority was stabilizing the two GSEs before they dragged down the entire system. Trillions of dollars worth of their securities were coursing through the financial bloodstream, and we were afraid they could poison it. Their paper had been considered a safe investment around the world, and now we were fielding calls from nervous officials from sovereign wealth funds and foreign governments who wanted to make sure the GSEs themselves were safe. Some of them hadn't even realized the U.S. government didn't officially backstop Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So Hank decided to ask Congress for the authority to stabilize both mortgage giants, to make explicit the long-standing implicit guarantee that Washington would stand behind the two firms. As with Lehman, he was worried that merely asking for extraordinary powers could confirm how dire the situation was and accelerate the panic. There was a related catch-22. The vast financial authority the Treasury would need to provide a credible backstop for these behemoths seemed politically unrealistic, while requesting an inadequate amount of money could raise doubts about the government's commitment to keeping them afloat. But we all agreed we couldn't stand by and risk a default. So, rather than ask for a specific dollar amount, Hank asked for unlimited, his euphemism was unspecified, authority, to inject capital into Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. His bill also included some of the reforms he had pushed before the crisis, including a stronger regulator with the power to force Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac into receivership. Ben told Hank he'd support the Treasury 100%, just as Hank had supported the Fed in the earlier rescues. Hank and Ben testified before the Senate committee on July 15th, presenting a unified front about the importance of the proposed legislation to keep mortgage credit flowing, prevent further deterioration of the housing market, and protect the financial core. Hank's request for a blank check was greeted with skepticism, but he argued that if Congress gave him broad power, the market's anxieties about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac would dissipate, and he'd be less likely to have to use that power. "If you want to make sure it's used, make it small enough, and it'll be a self-fulfilling prophecy," he said. "If you've got a squirt gun in your pocket, you may have to take it out. If you've got a bazooka, and people know you've got it, you may not have to take it out." The deterrence argument made sense, but Hank's request for overwhelming firepower revealed concern that panic-riven markets were unlikely to ignore, and he soon knew he might ultimately have to use the bazooka. Hank was making a remarkably ambitious ask on behalf of a lame duck president with a 30% approval rating. Senator Bunning thundered that the bear rescue had been amateur socialism compared to this, and the politics of housing had been tough even before Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac ran off the rails, complicating a spirited debate in Washington about what, if anything, to do about the rising tide of foreclosures. Some of the public and most congressional Republicans opposed using tax dollars paid by renters and homeowners who were making their mortgage payments to provide relief for homeowners who weren't. But some of the public and most congressional Democrats felt just as strongly that the government wasn't doing enough to help homeowners in trouble. In fact, a fairly inconsequential mortgage relief provision that Barney Frank had inserted in the Fannie Mae Freddie Mac legislation was even more contentious on Capitol Hill than Hank's request for the fiscal bazooka, so much so that President Bush would forego a public bill signing when the legislation passed. But the legislation did pass. Personal relationships matter, and Hank had solid ones with congressional leaders in both parties. Most of them agreed to put the emergency ahead of politics. By the end of July, the Democratic-controlled Congress approved the Housing and Economic Recovery Act of 2008 and gave immense power to a Republican administration, proving Washington was capable of doing courageous things when a crisis demanded it, though perhaps no earlier than that. The new legislation also gave the Treasury and the Fed a chance to look under the hood of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, uncovering some ugly surprises. Fed and OCC examiners concluded that both firms were functionally insolvent, with flimsy capital cushions that were mostly accounting fictions. Hank and his team at Treasury soon decided the only solution was to persuade their new regulator, the Federal Housing Finance Agency, to force Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac into conservatorship, basically nationalization without day-to-day government control. It was an awkward situation. He had just told Congress he wouldn't need to use his bazooka, and the FHFA had just told Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac their capital cushions were adequate. But they weren't adequate, and Hank's top priority was avoiding a collapse, not protecting his reputation for consistency. And when Hank concluded he needed to unholster his bazooka after all, President Bush backed him. "It won't always look good, but we are going to do what we need to do to save the economy." This whatever-it-takes attitude drove almost everything we did during the crisis. We all felt these extraordinary times justified extraordinary actions. Hank brought in two of his former Goldman colleagues and a New York law firm to work on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in August. He also leaned hard on the FHFA, pressuring the regulator to reverse its assessment in ways he never would have dreamed of doing before or after the crisis. Hank wasn't even sure he had the legal power to have the government provide the necessary long-term guarantee for the 30-year mortgages that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac insured, since Congress had given Treasury only temporary authority, which would expire at the end of 2009. With the help of advisors from Morgan Stanley, Treasury did some clever financial engineering to create what was, in effect, a long-term guarantee. But Hank was so concerned he might be overstepping congressional intent that he confided to the president and a few of his Treasury colleagues that he was worried he might be impeached. Ultimately, everybody was so shocked when Hank fired his bazooka that nobody even raised that particular question. On September 5th, Hank and Ben gave the CEOs of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac the stunning news that the government was seizing control of their companies. They would lose their jobs, their shareholders would lose almost all their equity, and the Treasury would inject $100 billion into each company to avoid looming defaults on their debt and the mortgage-backed securities they guaranteed. It was the most aggressive federal intervention in financial markets since the Depression, and the run on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac quickly subsided because the companies and the mortgages they insured now had official government backing. But the run on the rest of the system only gained momentum. The week after the nationalization of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac saw the worst financial bloodbath since the crisis began. We had hoped that demonstrating the government's willingness to take extraordinary actions to prevent chaotic failures would calm the markets and at least buy us time to cobble together a solution for Lehman Brothers. But once again, our show of force did not have the effect we intended. Markets didn't breathe a sigh of relief. They concluded that if the government was worried enough to take such extraordinary measures, the situation must be even worse than it looked. Uncertainty drives fear, and nobody felt certain what would happen to troubled private firms that didn't have unique federal charters. We weren't certain either. We had crossed an even bigger Rubicon and averted an even more dangerous panic, but within days, we'd have a still bigger and more dangerous problem on our hands. Chapter 4. The Inferno. September 2008 to October 2008. The fire burned for more than a year before it consumed Lehman Brothers, but many Americans still believe the financial crisis began with Lehman's collapse. It eclipsed all that came before and seemed responsible for all that followed. But it was more of a symptom than a cause of the weaknesses in the system. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, AIG, and Merrill Lynch were all much larger than Lehman, and all arrived at the brink of collapse around the same time. In fact, Lehman exemplified the factors from which the crisis stemmed. It was a loosely regulated, heavily over-leveraged, deeply interconnected non-bank, with too much exposure to the real estate market and too much dangerously runnable short-term financing. What made the story of Lehman different was that it ended in a disaster. Its demise was the most consequential moment of the crisis, and probably the least understood. Lehman was the nightmare we had been trying to prevent for a year, an uncontrolled failure of a systemically important financial institution during a panic. Since we had saved Bear Stearns in similar circumstances 6 months earlier, we had just saved Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac a week earlier, and we would go on to save AIG 2 days later, many observers assumed we had let Lehman fail on purpose, and quite a few praised us for doing so. But we did not let Lehman fail on purpose. We didn't even discuss whether or not to try to save Lehman, as we had with Bear and would with AIG. We knew we had to do everything in our power to try to prevent its collapse, but everything in our power turned out to be insufficient. In the end, Lehman did not have a buyer that was willing and able to stand behind its obligations, as Bear had with J.P. Morgan. There was no congressional authorization for the government to stand behind Lehman, as there was for Fannie and Freddie, and Lehman did not have enough solid collateral the Fed could lend against to keep it afloat in a structure the market would accept, as AIG did with its insurance businesses. We helped contribute to the confusion about our motives with some statements we made after Lehman's collapse, when we did not want to rattle the markets by admitting we had been powerless to save a systemic firm. But we had no practical option to save Lehman without a private buyer. Our mindset had not changed in the 6 months since our close call with Bear, but neither had our constraints. We could not inject capital into Lehman, guarantee its liabilities, buy its assets, or wind it down in an orderly fashion, so our nightmare scenario came true. That nightmare scenario finally helped us persuade Congress to give us the authority we needed, which would eventually enable us to put out the fire. But we wish we had been able to avoid the scenario in the first place. The pain of Lehman's failure and its aftermath wouldn't be limited to Lehman's shareholders and executives, including Hank's brother Dick, a senior vice president at the firm, or even its counterparties and creditors in the financial system. It would be felt throughout the global economy. Lehman Brothers, Circling the Drain. Lehman followed a familiar path to peril, gambling its franchise on subprime mortgage securities, commercial real estate, and other highly leveraged investments that were highly profitable until they weren't. As Lehman's losses mounted and short sellers started betting on its demise, Hank and Tim had pressured its CEO, Dick Fuld, to find a buyer before confidence in his firm completely evaporated. But the terms he was willing to offer potential investors suggested a lack of urgency, and there wasn't much interest in an overextended investment bank, especially when Fold was still playing hard to get. On Wednesday, September 10th, as Fold pre-announced an ugly third-quarter loss, he tried to blunt the impact by announcing a plan to spin Lehman's toxic assets into a separate company. But that just seemed to confirm the toxicity of the assets he wanted to shed. A reprise of the Bear Stearns endgame was underway. Lenders demanding more collateral, hedge funds closing brokerage accounts, ratings agencies threatening downgrades. The markets smelled a corpse, and we feared the fallout. Lehman had more than 100,000 creditors, more than 900,000 open derivatives contracts, and short-term borrowings more than twice those of Bear. It wouldn't go down quietly. If Lehman had been a commercial bank, the FDIC could have seized it, guaranteed its liabilities, and resolved it to avoid a messy bankruptcy. But no one in the government had the power to do that for a non-bank, so Lehman needed a buyer, just as Bear Stearns had needed a buyer. Bank of America agreed to take a look, but didn't sound serious. Barclays, a UK-based bank, expressed more genuine interest, but Fold, who still thought he could pick and choose his suitor, was skeptical about the fit, and British regulators said they had concerns as well, concerns that would turn out to be consequential. Meanwhile, confidence in several of the other major U.S. firms was eroding rapidly. We decided to bring Wall Street's top CEOs to the New York Fed on Friday night, September 12th, to try to organize a private sector solution, perhaps something like the Bear deal, with Wall Street firms taking on risk instead of the Fed, or together with the Fed, to help another larger and stronger firm acquire Lehman, or perhaps even something like the 1998 deal where the New York Fed encouraged 14 counterparties of long-term capital management to band together to buy the firm outright and liquidate its assets. This time, Wall Street had even greater reason to help avoid a collapse. Merrill Lynch looked like it would be the next domino to fall after Lehman, and then Morgan Stanley. Not even Goldman Sachs, the investment bank with the strongest balance sheet and largest liquidity cushion, could survive an all-out run on its business model. Unfortunately, we weren't optimistic that something workable would emerge. Lehman was much bigger than LTCM had been at the time of its collapse, and its assets were much shakier. Meanwhile, the other firms whose cash would be needed for a rescue were much more fragile than they had been in 1998, and they didn't have much capital to spare to keep a competitor from imploding. They had to worry about their own resilience to shocks, because there was no reason to think the shocks would end anytime soon. AIG, the massive insurer that insured many of their securities against default, had lost half its value that week and was besieged by margin calls. An internal New York Fed email warned that even as Lehman circled the drain, Wall Street was just as nervous about AIG. "I am hearing worse than LEH. Every bank and dealer has exposure to them." It was chilling to think how disastrous the situation would have been if Fannie and Freddie had been imploding as well, but the situation was pretty disastrous even after they were nationalized and stabilized. Meanwhile, Washington was becoming a cauldron of burn-the-arsonists' fervor, with politicians from both parties expressing increasing anger at Wall Street bailouts. The broader economy had not yet felt the full effects of the mounting panic. The Fed had not even cut rates in August, as the distress on Wall Street took time to reach Main Street. But there were now signs of extreme strain, with auto sales plunging and layoffs rising sharply. Understandably, Americans were enraged and puzzled by the extraordinary efforts being made to rescue the bankers responsible for the mess. Meanwhile, editorials in the Financial Times and Wall Street Journal, as well as the non-financial press, were imploring us to stop rewarding failure. As Lehman entered its endgame, Hank and his team put out the word that taxpayers would not subsidize a Lehman deal. This was a negotiating tactic, not a policy decision. He was trying to motivate the private sector to assume as much of Lehman's bad assets as possible, to increase the likelihood that a Bear Stearns-like rescue would be possible. But this was one of the few moments during the crisis when we were not all on the same page. Tim thought that telling the private sector it was on its own would intensify the run, and he was concerned that a no-government-money proclamation would hurt our credibility if the Fed did get the opportunity to assist a buyer with a Bear Stearns-type loan. But Hank said he would gladly reverse his position if we got an opportunity to save Lehman. We all knew that if the government needed to take some risks to get Lehman sold through a Bear-type deal, we would do it, even if we didn't like it, because a Lehman collapse would be far costlier in terms of financial and economic stability than a Lehman bailout. We were determined to avoid disruptive failures of major institutions until we could draw a circle of protection around the system's core, and at that point, we didn't have the power to build that kind of firewall. Our disagreement was about negotiating and messaging tactics, not our ultimate determination to do whatever we could to prevent a destabilizing collapse of a systemic firm. By the closing bell on Friday, Lehman was down to its last $2 billion in cash, just as Bear had been on its last day. At the New York Fed, Tim and Hank warned the leaders of Wall Street's top firms that a Lehman default would be catastrophic for all of them, so they needed to work together to prevent it. The New York Fed swarmed all weekend with bankers, lawyers, accountants, and regulators working against the clock to avoid a meltdown. One team met with potential Lehman acquirers to identify the bad assets they wanted to leave behind, while another worked with a consortium of Wall Street banks to encourage them to take on some or all of these bad assets. Everyone who reviewed Lehman's books was appalled. Bank of America told us it wouldn't even consider a deal unless it could leave behind $70 billion in bad assets. Barclays identified $52 billion it wouldn't take. The Wall Street executives analyzing Lehman's real estate portfolio concluded it was only worth about half what the firm claimed. The industry had some incentive to exaggerate the problems to encourage the government to help, but Lehman clearly had a huge capital hole that would have to be filled to complete any deal, posing as much as 10 times the risk the Fed had taken with Bear. That was a daunting hole for a private sector consortium to try to fill. And the CEOs of stronger firms had a legitimate concern that markets would punish them if it looked like they were now responsible for rescuing failing rivals. What would happen Monday if another consortium was needed to rescue AIG, a firm with tens of millions of life insurance customers and tens of billions of dollars worth of retirement assets? On Saturday morning, AIG alerted the Fed it might need a $30 billion bridge loan. By evening, the request had skyrocketed to $60 billion. Still, the news was not all bad that Saturday night. Bank of America was working out a deal to buy Merrill Lynch without government or industry assistance, which helped explain why its executives had shown so little interest in shopping for Lehman. We were relieved to have one existential threat diffused, even though it meant only one potential buyer left for Lehman. And by the end of the night, the Barclays-Lehman merger looked like a real possibility. The Wall Street CEOs had agreed in principle to take on the risk of a big slug of Lehman's distressed assets to help Barclays buy the firm and avoid a damaging default. There were still unanswered questions, and we suspected last-minute Fed assistance might be necessary to close the deal. Barclays CEO Bob Diamond also raised a troubling issue. British law required a shareholder vote before the merger could be finalized, and he wasn't sure his firm would be able to guarantee Lehman's obligations until the deal was done. That would clearly be a problem, but it didn't feel like the kind of problem that would scuttle a deal with Armageddon hanging in the balance. We figured that if the other issues could be resolved, we'd work something out with the British. We figured wrong. On Sunday morning, British regulators blocked the deal. Callum McCarthy, the UK's top financial regulator, told Tim he wasn't sure Barclays had enough capital to take on Lehman's risk, or enough capacity to guarantee Lehman's troubled assets. He said that in any case, Barclays wouldn't be permitted to backstop Lehman's obligations until its shareholders approved a merger that he didn't sound willing to approve himself, and a shareholder vote could take weeks or even months to arrange. Tim told him the markets needed immediate certainty about Lehman's fate, So delaying the deal was tantamount to killing it at a moment when global financial stability was at stake. McCarthy's response was, "Good luck." Hank made a last-ditch call to ask UK Finance Minister Alastair Darling to waive the requirements for a shareholder vote, so Barclays could stand behind Lehman right away. But Darling made it clear he didn't intend to help, because he didn't want British taxpayers on the hook for Lehman's problems. As Hank reported to Tim, he didn't want to import our cancer. The Barclays deal was dead. We were frustrated by the refusal of UK regulators to help avoid a cataclysm, but they had some legitimate concerns. Their banking system was 4 times larger than ours as a percentage of our respective economies, and equally fragile. Importing Lehman's disease to Barclays could have exposed their taxpayers to serious losses if the combined firm ultimately required a government rescue. The British weren't crazy to worry that Barclays would end up like the proverbial drunk who tries to help another drunk out of a ditch, but ends up falling into the ditch himself. As unthinkable as it seemed, we were out of options. We didn't have the authority to fill Lehman's capital hole or guarantee its obligations on our own. All we had was the Fed's power to lend against solid collateral. The Fed did have some discretion about what counted as acceptable collateral, but some of the sharpest minds in government and finance had just reviewed Lehman's assets, and the verdict had been as brutal as the markets. Lehman appeared to be deeply insolvent. A 2013 study would conclude its capital hole might have been as big as $200 billion. And while the Fed would have helped finance an acquisition as it had with Bear, it couldn't rescue an insolvent firm in the midst of a run. Apart from the large losses on Lehman's balance sheet, the market's confidence in the strength of its businesses, its brand, and its management had seriously eroded. We had months of evidence of its inability to raise capital, sell assets, or finance its real estate portfolio at anywhere near its stated value. We were willing to take risks in extremis, but the Fed's tools, limited to lending against collateral, could not make Lehman viable. Even if the Fed had decided, contrary to the available evidence, that the value of the firm justified lending to Lehman on a massive scale, lending into what had already become an unstoppable run on the firm would only have given some of the firm's remaining creditors and counterparties a chance to flee at taxpayer expense as Lehman's businesses continued inexorably to erode. That kind of bridge loan to nowhere would have created huge losses for the government without quelling the panic, and the backlash might have crippled our ability to act the next time a major institution needed help, which, as it turned out, would be Tuesday. A lender of last resort can help reduce the risk that viable companies go down because of temporary liquidity problems, but it can't make fundamentally non-viable companies viable. If markets believe a firm is irrevocably insolvent, a secured loan cannot stop a run or bring back fleeing customers and counterparties. At 1:45 a.m. on Monday, September 15th, Lehman filed for bankruptcy, the largest in American history. The Fed tried to apply foam on the runway by stating its willingness to lend to banks and investment banks against just about any form of collateral, but the explosion was devastating anyway. The cost of insuring the bonds of Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs doubled on Monday as markets lost confidence in the investment bank business model. The run also extended into the commercial banking sector. Citi's credit default swaps spiked, reflecting growing market fears that even too-big-to-fail banks might fail, and spooked depositors withdrew twice as much from Washington Mutual as they had withdrawn after the run on IndyMac. Even the industrial giant General Electric struggled to roll over its commercial paper, a troubling sign that the financial virus had infected the broader economy. Banks, businesses, and households around the world retreated into a defensive shell. Pension and retirement funds plummeted in value, and the vicious cycle of foreclosures, layoffs, and financial panic intensified. Foreign banks that had borrowed from U.S. money market funds and U.S. banks lost access to dollars, and emerging markets were also deprived of financial oxygen. the Fed substantially expanded its swap lines to provide dollars to foreign central banks and generally provided markets in the United States and abroad with unprecedented liquidity during an unprecedented liquidity crunch. But the Fed's short-term lending could not by itself fix a global crisis of confidence. After Lehman failed, editorialists in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and other influential outlets were pleased that we had resisted the temptation to use public dollars to rescue a failed enterprise. For a brief moment, critics who had vilified us as bailout kings hailed our commitment to free market discipline, our willingness to teach Wall Street a lesson by letting irresponsible speculators pay for their sins. But the praise was misguided, as was the scattered criticism that we were idiots to let Lehman fail. We would have rescued Lehman if we could have. Yes, Hank had suggested before Lehman went down that the government wouldn't help, but that was a tactic to pressure the private sector to participate in a rescue that the Fed and the Treasury lacked the power to execute on their own. In the days following the collapse, Hank and Ben also noted in congressional testimony that the markets had time to prepare for Lehman's failure, which gave some critics the impression that we had expected the resulting damage to be modest. But we had agreed among ourselves that, at least for the moment, we needed to downplay our inability to save Lehman because we feared that such an admission would terrify the markets and accelerate the run. Public communication during a panic is both vitally important and incredibly difficult, and we were trying to find a balance between being blunt and being reassuring. We didn't help feed the myth that we chose failure to avoid confessing publicly that we were out of ammunition, but in reality, we just weren't able to prevent failure. The fall of Lehman dramatically accelerated the crisis, but a less frantic, less visible run on the financial system had been building for more than a year. In an analogy coined by the economist Edward Lazier, Lehman was the first major kernel of popcorn we couldn't prevent from popping, but it didn't create the heat in the pan. And even if we had somehow saved Lehman, we would have lacked the authority to turn down the heat to prevent other kernels from popping. We were in another catch-22 situation. We needed substantial new authorities, including the ability to put capital into teetering financial firms to stop the crisis. But we never could have gotten that authority from Congress without a spectacular failure like Lehman. And even then, it would be a struggle. We did not choose to let Lehman fail, but even if we had somehow found a solution for that firm, something else was eventually going to break. We had stretched our authority to its limits, but the limits were real, and it was now painfully clear that we couldn't put out the fire until we could deploy the full resources of the U.S. government. That Sunday night after Lehman's fate was sealed, we all agreed it was time to go to Congress to get the money and tools we needed. First, though, we had to deal with AIG, which was even bigger and more dangerous than Lehman, and was threatening to burn down what was left of the system. AIG, Free Market Day. Like Lehman, the global insurer AIG had fallen through the cracks of our broken regulatory system. Its insurance subsidiaries were regulated at the state level, while the Office of Thrift Supervision, the light-touch regulator of choice for institutions like Countrywide, IndyMac, and WaMu, purported to oversee its holding company. None of us had visibility into AIG, and none of us had paid close attention to the firm until it started to hemorrhage late that summer. But the more we learned about the company, the more we realized that letting it follow Lehman's path would be a recipe for a depression. AIG insured the lives, health, property, vehicles, and retirement accounts of 76 million customers, including 180,000 businesses that employed more than two-thirds of the American workforce. And thanks to its irresponsible financial products division, which resembled a hedge fund grafted on to a traditional insurance company, AIG also had $2.7 trillion worth of derivatives contracts, mostly credit default swaps insuring troubled financial instruments. If it collapsed, the other systemic banks and non-banks would lose their disaster insurance when they needed it most, it seemed like everyone was exposed to AIG, and no one was sure how exposed anyone else was, so an AIG default could inspire runs on just about any other financial firm. Now that default seemed imminent. AIG's stock plunged below $5 on Monday, down from more than $150 at its peak. Its counterparties were demanding huge amounts of additional collateral, and the ratings agencies were considering a crippling downgrade. It now looked like AIG needed at least $75 billion to stay afloat, the kind of hole only the government could fill at a time when banks were hoarding liquidity. We had never imagined that the Fed should help an insurer, and just a few days earlier we had doubted we could. But by Monday afternoon, it was clear that AIG was too big, too complex, and too broken to be rescued by the private sector, and that the system was in no shape to handle its collapse. As with Lehman, we didn't have a mechanism like the FDIC's Bank Resolution Authority that we could use to wind down AIG without bankruptcy and default, and we couldn't inject capital, guarantee liabilities, or buy assets. This time, though, we did think the Fed might be able to lend to AIG in amounts sufficient to stave off its collapse. Unlike investment banks, which have nothing if they don't have trust and confidence, AIG had a global empire of relatively stable income-generating insurance businesses. The Fed had the authority to lend against good collateral, and unlike Bear or Lehman, AIG had a collection of regulated insurance subsidiaries with premium-paying policyholders and mandatory reserves that it could use to back its loans. The markets had lost confidence in AIG's ability to survive a run on its funding, but its problems were primarily in its holding company, which housed its beleaguered financial products division. We thought the markets would recognize that its valuable insurance operations were sufficient to keep the enterprise fundamentally solvent and viable. Any loan to a failing company in the throes of a run would still be risky, and we knew it might only buy the system time to prepare for a default. But by Tuesday, AIG was about to file for bankruptcy if it didn't get the cash it needed, and the amount of cash it needed seemed to increase every hour. That afternoon, the Fed sent AIG a take-it-or-leave-it offer of an $85 billion credit line at a penalty interest rate in exchange for 79.9% of the firm, just below the threshold that would force the government to bring the company formally onto its balance sheet, but enough to ensure taxpayers would get most of the upside if the firm survived. AIG accepted the deal, even though one condition was that we would immediately replace its CEO. We knew the backlash would be intense, and we knew it would look like we were lurching. Barney Frank quipped that September 15th should be dubbed Free Market Day in honor of America's one-day commitment to market rigor between Lehman and AIG. But we didn't suddenly embrace or abandon any principles. We did what we could to prevent chaos, and we didn't do what we couldn't do. AIG had solid collateral, enough to secure the funding it needed to stay in business, while Lehman didn't. And even with AIG, we tried to drive a tough bargain, partly to maximize the protection for taxpayers, partly to minimize the moral hazard we'd create for the future. AIG's shareholders later sued because they thought they were treated too harshly, and as galling as that was, it did reflect our commitment to saving the broader system rather than everyone in it. Rescuing AIG was our least awful option at the time, and we tried to minimize its awfulness. Critics mocked us for sending Wall Street another message that failure would be rewarded, but most of the failures hadn't been rewarded. Over the course of the crisis, the CEOs of Countrywide, Bear, Fannie, Freddie, Merrill, Lehman, AIG, Citi, and Wachovia had all lost their jobs. The shareholders of every financial firm had seen their stock prices plunge. It's true that we had reduced some pain in the financial sector to avoid an all-out stampede by creditors and counterparties, which presumably created some moral hazard. But we weren't creating a particularly inviting path for future financiers to follow, and it would have been a bizarre act of hubris for us to let the financial system implode and drag down the economy just so we could feel righteous about the stern precedent we had set. We would have gladly let AIG fail if we thought the fallout could be limited to the company's executives and shareholders. But we did not want any systemically dangerous institution to fail at a time when we had no way to prevent the damage from escalating into a global catastrophe. Some critics were outraged that the Fed didn't insist on haircuts that would have reduced the payouts to AIG's creditors and counterparties, which instead received 100 cents on the dollar for their risky arrangements with a dying firm. In fact, the Fed didn't have the power to impose haircuts without triggering a default that would mean certain bankruptcy, and the creditors quickly rejected the idea of accepting even minuscule haircuts voluntarily. In any case, while haircuts for creditors of unraveling firms are sensible and just in normal times, and a common feature of the normal bankruptcy process, haircuts during a panic are a sure way to make the panic worse. They send a signal to creditors of other troubled firms that they're also risking a haircut if they don't run immediately, a phenomenon we would witness just a week later with Washington Mutual. The goal of crisis response should be to alleviate fears, not to confirm and amplify them. We understood why the public wanted to see financial firms pay the ultimate price for their recklessness. As the saying goes, capitalism without bankruptcy is like Christianity without hell. But policymakers who focus on retribution rather than stabilization during an epic crisis will only make the crisis more epic. As Ben has put it, if your neighbor sets his house on fire by smoking in bed, you want the fire department to put it out before it spreads to your house and your entire town, even though letting it burn would punish the perpetrator and send a strong message that smoking in bed will never be tolerated. It makes sense to try to avoid rewarding the reckless beyond what's needed to contain the fire, and to punish them appropriately while promoting stronger fire prevention measures after the fire is out. But the first priority has to be putting the fire out. It turned out that AIG was in even more dire straits than we thought. It would continue to unravel after its initial loan, and the rescue would end up expanding to an unthinkable $185 billion. Eventually, though, AIG would pay the money back with interest, in part by selling off operations, and the government would make a $23 billion profit. More important, we avoided the broader damage that would have followed AIG's default. The company's executives had helped put the entire system at risk, which made the public even more furious when they received bonuses that had been contracted before the crisis. From a public relations perspective, saving AIG was devastating. But in September 2008, on the day after Lehman's failure, failing to save AIG would have been calamitous. The end of an era. We had averted quite a few disasters, but that was not enough. Lehman's failure and the near failure of Merrill and AIG helped send markets into even deeper shock. The two surviving standalone investment banks both faced intensifying runs. Morgan Stanley's credit default swaps spiked higher than Lehman's had before it failed, while Goldman Sachs watched $60 billion worth of liquidity evaporate in a week. Corporate bond spreads widened twice as much as they had after the crash of 1929, suggesting fears of widespread bankruptcies among non-financial firms. Yields on short-term Treasury bills actually went negative, reflecting the frenetic flight to safety. Investors were so afraid of investing in anything that they were willing to pay the government to hold their cash. Ben got an email from the baseball statistics guru Bill James urging him to hang in there. At some point, the people who are saying it can't get any worse have to be right. It was still getting worse, and a new disaster erupted on Tuesday while we were finalizing the terms of our support for AIG. The Reserve Primary Fund, a money market fund that had invested heavily in Lehman's commercial paper, announced it could no longer pay its investors 100 cents on the dollar and was halting redemptions. Investors afraid that other money market funds would also break the buck and freeze their cash scrambled to pull $230 billion out of the industry that week, a scary run on quasi-banks that it operated without insurance for their quasi-deposits. Meanwhile, as money funds pulled back from risk to reassure their investors, they bought even less commercial paper and lent even less in the repo markets, intensifying the liquidity crisis for banks and non-banks. CEOs of highly rated non-financial companies like General Electric, Ford, and even Coca-Cola warned Hank that they were having trouble selling their paper, depriving them of the short-term funding they relied on to manage operations and pay their suppliers and workers. That would force them to cut back inventories and delay payments to small and mid-sized suppliers, which would in turn be forced to lay off workers. The crisis was about to spread, in a more concrete and palpable way, from Wall Street to Main Street. We were determined to stop the runs on money market funds, which invested $3.5 trillion for 30 million Americans, and commercial paper, which provided vital day-to-day liquidity that was the lifeblood of so many real economy companies. Hank's team came up with the idea of using Treasury's $50 billion Exchange Stabilization Fund to guarantee the money funds just as the FDIC guaranteed bank deposits. The Treasury Fund was supposed to be used to protect the value of the dollar only in an emergency, but there was a case to be made that stopping runs on money funds would prevent an economic collapse that could destroy the value of the dollar. Anyway, we believed that once Treasury announced the guarantee, it wouldn't have to spend or lend anything, because investors would stop running once they regained confidence the money funds were safe. And the Fed buttressed the new guarantee by launching a new entry in its alphabet soup of lending programs, the AMLF, Asset-Backed Commercial Paper Money Market Mutual Fund Liquidity Facility, a circuitous effort to thaw the market for asset-backed commercial paper by helping banks buy it from money funds. Within 2 weeks, the program was financing $150 billion worth of securities the market no longer trusted. The interventions worked. No other money market funds broke the buck, and since Treasury charged them all a premium for their new insurance policy, taxpayers ended up turning another profit. The extra liquidity from the Fed helped, but the real lesson was the power of a government guarantee. When crisis managers can credibly promise protection against catastrophic outcomes, market participants don't have to act in anticipation of those outcomes, so the feared outcomes don't happen. We had no authority to guarantee the liabilities of investment banks, so we spent some long hours pushing Morgan Stanley CEO John Mack and Goldman's Lloyd Blankfein to seek mergers with commercial banks that had stronger funding bases. At this point, Tim had tried to arrange so many shotgun marriages that Wall Street executives were calling him E-Harmony. But potential mega-mergers like Goldman Wachovia and Morgan City didn't really make sense. Wachovia and Citi had their own challenges, despite their insured deposits, and the matches raised two drunks in a ditch concerns. Meanwhile, we reluctantly encouraged the SEC to impose a temporary ban on the short selling of shares of financial firms, something we had resisted for months and never would have considered in less extreme circumstances. We hated the idea of prohibiting bets against companies in trouble. It felt like outlawing negative reviews, which could undermine confidence in the marketplace we wanted to protect. But Morgan Stanley was on the brink of collapse, and Goldman would have followed, with major commercial banks close behind. Then we wouldn't have had much left to protect. Both investment banks were desperately looking for strategic partners to make cornerstone equity investments that would help bolster their capital cushions and send a signal of confidence in the viability of their businesses. The Fed decided to allow both to become bank holding companies, but only on the condition that they raise significant private capital right away. Over the weekend of September 20th, Goldman Sachs worked to secure a $5 billion investment from Warren Buffett, which enabled the firm to raise another $5 billion from the public. And Morgan Stanley secured a commitment from Mitsubishi to buy 20% of the firm for $9 billion. The bank holding company designation by the Fed was vaguely reassuring to the market, but in reality it had few substantive implications. For example, Given the lending programs already in place, it didn't increase how much either investment bank could borrow from the Fed. The capital injections by private investors provided a limited vote of confidence, but the financial fire was still raging. We were dangerously behind the curve of the panic, and our existing arsenal of tools had proven to be too weak to contain the force of the run. We needed a way to forestall disasters for the entire financial sector, rather than stepping in one firm at a time, and there would be no way to do that without congressional buy-in and taxpayer dollars. For months, we had wanted to ask for stronger emergency authorities, but Congress had signaled it would need more compelling evidence that we really needed more power, and we had feared that a conspicuous public rejection would intensify market concerns about our ability to end the crisis. But now we were staring into the abyss of a second depression, and for the first time, we believed we might be able to get a reluctant Congress to act. In a meeting in the Roosevelt Room of the White House on September 18th, Ben and Hank told President Bush that the time had come to go to Congress. Ben emphasized that there was nothing more the Fed could do on its own. So the president gave us the go-ahead to go to Capitol Hill to ask for the firepower we needed so we could make sure there would be no more Lehman-style failures. Late that Friday night, Hank sent Congress a 3-page draft of a troubled assets relief program, a proposal to give Treasury the power to buy $700 billion worth of the toxic mortgage securities that had poisoned the financial system. The dollar figure was somewhat arbitrary. $500 billion didn't feel quite large enough relative to the $11 trillion residential mortgage market, while anything closer to $1 trillion felt too large for the political system to swallow. But the goal was to create the perception and the reality of overwhelming force. We hoped to bolster confidence in endangered financial firms by removing some of the illiquid assets weighing down their balance sheets. We also hoped the purchases would revive the market for similar mortgage assets that we didn't buy, effectively recapitalizing the entire financial system. This was similar to a so-called break-the-glass plan that Treasury and the Fed had developed jointly in April, and it was clearly time to break the glass. The mere act of publicly advocating for TARP carried some risk. Hank and Ben needed to convince Congress the situation was dire enough to justify extraordinary action, but excessively alarmist rhetoric could end up inflaming the panic. It was the same communications tightrope we had walked throughout the crisis, and Hank's bare-bones proposal created an immediate political firestorm of its own. It was intended as a mere outline, a response to Senator Dodd's request that he not present Congress a fait accompli, but critics mocked its lack of legislative details. The draft also included virtually unlimited flexibility for Treasury to spend $700 billion without congressional interference or even judicial review, prompting accusations that Hank was seeking unprecedented power. Many Republicans attacked the plan as big government socialism, while many Democrats complained that it lacked restrictions on executive compensation and relief for homeowners. At a series of hearings on Capitol Hill, Hank and Ben were repeatedly pilloried for putting Wall Street ahead of Main Street, for coddling arsonists rather than letting them burn. One senator told Ben that calls to his office about the proposed legislation were running 50% no, 50% hell no. Still, away from the cameras and the congressional posturing, Hank was making progress toward a bipartisan deal when Senator John McCain, the Republican presidential nominee, suddenly announced he was suspending his campaign and flying back to Washington to help resolve the crisis, thrusting the negotiations into the whirlwind of presidential politics. Hank warned McCain that if he torpedoed TARP, Hank would publicly say that he was sabotaging the economy, which, of course, he did not want to have to do. He even suggested that Ben might support him, which was not, in fact, something Ben would have done as an independent Fed chair, but Hank was willing to bluff a bit to avert a catastrophe. President Bush and Hank met at the White House that Thursday, September 25th, with presidential candidates McCain and Obama and congressional leaders of both parties, a famously unproductive meeting that ended in a raucous shouting match after key Republicans remained resistant to TARP. The politics of financial crises are always difficult, even when they don't erupt before presidential elections, because the actions necessary to stabilize financial systems are never popular. This is why it's so vital for crisis managers to have the tools they need before a crisis, so that they don't need to rely on political leaders to take political risks in real time under the public microscope. As Tim's aide Lee Sachs pointed out, a fire department shouldn't have to call a town meeting to approve the purchase of new equipment to fight a fire that's already burning out of control. In fact, on that same Thursday, the fire burned down another huge firm, Washington Mutual, which overtook IndyMac as the largest FDIC-insured bank ever to fail. FDIC Chair Sheila Bair worked out a deal for J.P. Morgan Chase to buy WaMu and protect its deposits without assistance from her agency's insurance fund. But the FDIC's deal not only wiped out WaMu's shareholders, which was appropriate, it imposed heavy losses on WaMu's senior debt holders. In other words, it allowed WaMu to default on its debt obligations, the result we had been so desperate to avoid for other firms. This kind of haircut makes sense in ordinary times, forcing creditors to suffer the consequences of their unwise loans, but not during panics, when it sends a message that creditors of other financial firms should run. Bair thought our rescues had created too much moral hazard and saw WaMu's failure as a teachable moment for the financial system. She was also very protective of the FDIC's deposit insurance fund, often citing her legal obligation to seek the least cost option for her agency. But there was a systemic risk exception to that obligation when financial stability was at stake, and haircutting WaMu seemed like it would create significant risk of more bank failures, more FDIC losses, more rescues, and more moral hazard. Sure enough, the next morning there was a run on Wachovia, the next domino in line, and the fourth largest bank in the country by assets. The cost of insuring Wachovia's senior debt against default doubled, and the price of its 10-year bonds dropped by nearly two-thirds in one day. Once again, we needed a weekend solution for a collapsing megabank, and while Citigroup and Wells Fargo were both interested, neither was willing to buy Wachovia and stand behind its obligations without government help. Initially, Bair was inclined to rerun her WaMu playbook of haircutting senior creditors to protect the FDIC fund and avoid moral hazard. But after some debate, she agreed to invoke the systemic risk exception to avoid another chaotic default that would have ramped up the panic. That didn't quite end the drama over Wachovia. The FDIC initially announced a sale to Citi while agreeing to take some of the risk of Wachovia's bad mortgage assets, but changed its mind when Wells Fargo made a new offer that required neither haircuts nor FDIC help. This was an understandable reversal, but the government's zigzags were creating all kinds of uncertainty in the markets. The appearance of lurching without a coherent strategy was mostly the consequence of the government's limited powers, fragmented authorities, and the general messiness of financial crises. But it didn't exactly bolster confidence that we had a handle on the situation, and this limited the effectiveness of the tools we did have. We wanted to assure the markets there would be no more Lehman's or WaMu's, and to make those assurances credible, we needed TARP. Over Wachovia weekend, Hank and his team hashed out a deal with congressional leaders that added oversight measures to his minimalist draft, as well as restrictions on golden parachutes for CEOs at participating institutions. Hank had resisted a stricter crackdown on executive compensation in order to limit the stigma associated with TARP, because it wouldn't work unless banks agreed to participate, even if they weren't on the brink of failure. Still, his first priority was a deal, and Treasury got everything Hank thought he needed in the deal. And McCain and Obama both showed political courage by supporting it. Nevertheless, on Monday, September 29th, the House narrowly rejected the TARP bill. The S&P 500 dropped 9%, wiping out a record $1 trillion in value. It was a deeply frightening moment, jolting some recalcitrant House Republicans to their senses. After Senate leaders added some tax breaks to TARP, they passed the bill on Wednesday with broad